Very nice. It came out in English. Very nice. Okay. First of all, let's just record that today is Sunday, March 16th, 2008. Let me just mention that obviously next Sunday, there's no shul. It's the final day of the Purim Mishulash, obviously. But next Monday, shul will be normal. Before I begin the shul, I just want to relate to two questions that a lot of people in the Kollel asked me. And at first, I didn't know what you were talking about. Only afterwards, when I saw it in print, did I understand the questions. One question, which is extremely important, I'm reading from a news release about Rabbi Dan Siegel, a famous mashgiach, darshan, and rabbi from Israel, and in a recent speech on the massacre in the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, in which he claimed that the Holy Land's Jewish community is in grave danger, even greater than that of outside Eretz Yisrael, because of rebelling against the Shalosh Shvuot, the Gemara, in Ketuvah, Daf Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph. You're familiar with the Gemara. Relax. Rabbi Siegel continued by saying, only the Torah and mitzvah Jews observe here provide protection. Rav Siegel also derided the belief that the Jewish state is part of the Torah belief in Geula, saying that the attack was a sign from heaven, and mentioning how many tears the previous Satmar Rebbe, Reb Yoelish Teitelbaum, shed on what he considered unnecessary bloodshed. I'll give it to you. You don't have to take it. Now, I want to tell you that this was picked up in part of the Haredi press, and it was picked up all over the world. It went on the website. And here you have a famous mashgiach, and this is what he has to say about the terrible tragedy. I want to quote to you a Rambam in Hilchot Shuva. And Baruch, as long as you live, I want you to recall this Rambam. Hilchot Shuva, Perikimel, Halachi Yud Aleph. You should know this Rambam by heart. HaParish Minit Sibor. And the Rambam's defining, he mentions one of the people that have no share in the world to come is HaParish Midakei Tzibor. What does that mean? And this is the Rambam's definition. Afal Pi Shelo Ava Averot. He didn't do any sins. He was a tzaddik. He ate only glatt kosher. Didn't drink chalavakam. Whatever he considered tzaddik. Didn't do any sin in the world. Ela Nivdal Me'edat Yisrael. V'yeno osem mitzvah b'klalam v'no nichnas b'tzaratan v'lo mitaneh b'tainitan. I repeat again, v'lo nichnas b'tzaratan. 8 young boys massacred on top of open gemaras. They were buried with blood-stained gemaras. Ela holeich b'darkol k'echad megei aretz v'yeno echad mehem. This is not his world. He's like the Gentile, like the UN, who compared what happened at Merkaz HaRav to our attacks in Gaza. No one yet has opened their mouth here to the Secretary General of the UN. What is your solution, Your Eminence, for stopping rockets from being shot in on endless cities and settlements in Israel? Ein lo chelek liolam haba. I don't think I have to say another word. And this is my response to this so-called rabbi. And I can tell you more. A few months ago, his brother died. His brother's name was Yisrael Segel. Those of you who don't live in Israel and are just here in a bubble of American civilization don't recognize the name. Those of you who live in Israel should recognize the name. Yisrael Segel was a famous TV personality. He did not sit shiva for his brother. His brother was a Panovich graduate who left the path. Did not sit shiva. That's the psak he got. Panovich should have sat shiva that that they raise graduates like this who leave the path. Beyond my comprehension. I refer you to the volume on Bernard Revel. Look at the appendix where Rabbi Revel deals with the question of relations with Jews who have left the path. No comment is necessary. But imagine, didn't sit Shiva, and it was Paskin like that. The brother is a face, a mumach. They're missing a chazonish in Hilchat Shchita. They're missing a world of understanding. Why don't you raise the question, how can Panovich so fail that this is what happens to their students? I happen to know a guy named Barak Kefer. I know how much he's suffering because one student of his wrote an article on my late apostasy. And she studied with me in Michwala, one of my top students. And I'm suffering. I'm asking, where did I fail? But no, he didn't sit Shiva. And at a time like this, to open his mouth with such vulgarity, this is the Rambam. HaPorish min HaTzibur. You can be a glatt kosher, you can be a tzaddik, but if you're not part of Klal Yisrael, and you don't mourn when they mourn, ein lo chelek l'olam haba. No comment is necessary. The second question I got, didn't know what the heck you were talking about. Is the Rav HaTzadik, not HaTzadik? So you see, print today is cheap. It's one of the few things in life that cost 1/100th what it cost years ago. The truth is today they should put one advertisement in a book and give it away free. When Bernard Rebbe was published the first time, type was set by hand, linear type. You have any idea what I'm talking about? Today, you bring a manuscript, computerized, they won't even look at it until I have to worry when I finish, not worry, but when I finish writing, I first have to finish to take me another year to hire someone to put the whole thing into a computer program. So far, only six chapters, I think, are computerized. Jack, you can correct me, 7 chapters, perhaps. Print is cheap, so everything gets printed today. So I take a look, call Hamavasa, where's the Rav Tzadik in search of modern Orthodox saints? Now I hope Noach Greenfield will listen to the words I have to say. The amratzit of your generation is just overwhelming. But what can we do? Yiftach b'doro b'shmul b'doro. But I quote like Kefir again, Yiftach bleib Yiftach. He may be the equivalent of Shmuel in 2009, but he's still Yiftach. I read the article. I couldn't believe my ears. Rabbi Lichtenstein said about the Rav, Zal, didn't say Zatzal. From that he derives that the Rav was a Tzaddik. And then he goes into a whole tirade that we don't hear these magnificent stories about the Rav. Now, let me explain something to you. Asher, let the Rebbe handle it. I was just going to mention Asher. Asher has chassidic a bend. Fine. Adam Law is a chassidish Jew. I've taught over the years more chassidish Jews. Some people in my family have that chassidic inclination. That's fine. I respect it. And you tell wondrous stories about your rabbeim. That's part of being a chassid. My wife comes from Belzer Chassid, and those of you who are on the tour saw what I did to the Belzer Rebbe's Gabbai, who saw with their own eyes, who was on the tour from her. By Nishalala. Thank God, Eitan will testifies that the Rebbe's telling the truth. So I'm very happy to hear that. Thank you. Baruch Hashem. So, all right, that's Chassidus. Gentlemen, in the literature world, I learned in Lakewood. I did not hear one Chassidish, pardon the term, story about Rav Aaron Cutler. Not one. The closest that I come to it is pure Litvish, is with Rav Aaron. And again, I can't go into all the details. I believe I wrote this up already in my new book. I met the person who was the caterer. He couldn't believe I knew the story. So I was learning in Lakewood at the time. Rav Aaron comes to Israel the first time to succeed Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. His father-in-law had just died as the Eitz Chaim Rosh Yeshiva. He's Masada Kedushin at a wedding in Yerushalayim, right in the Meir Shalom area, the Gula area, the Beit Yisrael is in Beit Yisrael. Those days, as some of our leaders would like to happen again, the border was 2 blocks from there. Okay? The middle of the wedding, the Jordanians started shooting in. They killed 2 people at the wedding. Rabbarin jumped under a table. And they heard Rabbarin saying, Ribbono shel olam, ichtaf nach leben, valich muz nach lernen. And he was praying to the Almighty and saying, I still have to live because I have to learn. And when the story reached Lakewood, we told Pilpulim on top of Pilpulim, look at Rabbi, became a Misavot. Look at Rabbarin Kotler. At that time in life, he was well into his 60s. He was the Kletzka Lakewood Rosh Yeshiva. He was Echad Megadol Yisrael. He stood at the head of Chinuch Atzmai. He revitalized Agudat Yisrael in America. He was the head of the American Moesed Gedolei HaTorah. And all he could tell the Ribbono shel Olam, I still have more to learn. And from that you see that everything a person does comes from his learning. If you know how to learn, then you have certain achrayut to klal Yisrael. But learning is everything. Nor is that a Hasidic story or a Litvish story. Now, I can tell you 1,000 such stories about the Rav, his ibige gebenkeit, his learning, his gemilut chesed, his sensitivity. But Ribbono shel Olam, zelavaisen moifsim, I refer you to the latest issue of B'chol D'Rechecho Daheyu, BDD, published by Bar Ilan, where a guy named Aaron Rakefit was sick and disgusted and finally let off some steam. And in his little article, they gave me a page. They're idiots because the other page has a little more, and it's blank. They make me take out 2 paragraphs. They had all the room in the world to publish. And there I tell you clearly that the Rav claimed he had no Ruach HaKodesh. And I say, if my Rebbe didn't have Ruach HaKodesh, how could I ever have to read what I'm writing there? But you want, let me tell Noach Greenfield a story about the Rav. Zeicha Tzadik Livracha. And you tell me whether it's Chassidish or this is Ben Teira. The Rav would give his shir in mid-Manhattan on the west side Tuesday night in Moria. Moria, which no longer exists, was built around the Rav coming to these Galiziana, as the Rav used to say, his Galiziana, Balabatim, all diamond merchants, and the Rav had to give a shiur every Tuesday, or one Shabbos a month he spent in Manhattan, and I think Rosh Hashanah, or I don't think Yom Kippur, but I think Rosh Hashanah he may have spent. I know with the Chagim, occasionally he was in Manhattan. After the Rav would give his shiur Tuesday night, he'd take a few of his close Talmidim, and go to visit Rebbetzin Heller, Reb Chaim Heller's widow. Now, Reb Chaim Heller's widow was a very, just a simple woman, a nice lady, or lady who had been married to one of the greatest gedolim the Rav ever met, or that Aaron Rakefet was privileged to feast his eyes upon Reb Chaim Heller. I've given endless lectures on the relationship between the Rav and Reb Chaim. He went to visit her. People who knew her said to me, I don't want to quote members of the West family, said, what could my father speak with her about? What did they have in common? Well, what is he going to talk with her? Reb Chaim Heller, he spoke about a Rambam and a Sefer Mitzvot and a Chapin in a Mabushe Yontov and a Chapin in Dinitziv. I mean, Reb Chaim Heller knew everything. If the Rav had a question in the place he wanted to know biblical criticism and had to refute it, he went to Reb Chaim Heller. But he went to visit the Rebbetzin because she was an almana. And she should know that she's not forgotten. Just because her husband died, she is not forgotten. All right? Chassidic story or Litvish? I don't know. Noah Greenfield, I hope he is listening. One final story. My favorite story about the Rav. Lo Aleinu, when his wife died, he was a Sheva Kli. Some men can't adjust to life after their wife dies. It's not a simple matter. Some men have the ability to go further. Okay. So the Rav would go to her grave quite often. And this was, again, some of you know, again, if you've heard Rabbi here, if you've heard Aaron Rakepitz lecture, this is again Soloveitchik Vilna Gaon tradition. You can find it in that famous volume, Halichot V'Halachot B'Chassidot by Rabbi Wertheim. It's a wonderful volume. So the Rav went to the Beit Olam. One day he's there on a Chveis, it's Chodesh Elul, it probably was a Friday morning, he used to go Friday, Chodesh Elul, and Jews come to the cemetery, Chodesh Elul, and as the Rav is walking out, and he's an old man, it's in the 70s, and he has a beard, a full beard, you guys love it, the Rav has a beard, he's from, to me the beard hurts, because it shows Avelut, he never took his beard off after his wife died. The Rav that I know is without a beard, a Van Dyke, and alive and kicking and shaving, and a gentleman, and etc. So the Rav is walking out, Ibiga Begin, an old man with a little beard, and a reformed Jew and his wife are coming, and they go over, they say, Rabbi, could you help us? We don't know how to say the memorial prayer at our parents' graves. Could you come? And the Rav says, of course. He goes with them, makes the kelmale, goes to the other grave. And when he's finished, they say, thank you, Rabbi. And they try to shtup him a $10 bill. The Rav says, no, it's not necessary. And they thought it was enough money, so he took out another, an American balabas, took out another $10 bill. No, it's not necessary. That's quite okay. You should have a good Sabbath, and your parents' memory should be a blessing. And the Rav walks back, and there's a car waiting for him, and someone was watching this. It's not a big cemetery. I was there. I saw. I know that I have a picture of it. I was there. I mean, I was in the cemetery in 1998, I think it was. I went to ask Mechila from the Rav when I was in the final stages of preparing my work, the two volumes for publication. So this Jew comes over to this couple, says, do you know who that was? They say, no. That was Rabbi Soloveitchik, the most important rabbi in the world. And they, you know, in Boston, they heard the name distantly. Sunday morning, they were at Maimonides, and they made a multi-$1,000 donation in honor of the Rav. All right, that's my favorite story. Is it Chassidus or Litvish? I leave it for you to decide. But that's what I want to say to this Noah Greenfield, Rebbeinu Shalom, because Rabbi Aaron didn't say Seichetz Ladik Lefracha. Rabbi Aaron wanted to save a little time, that's all. Rebbeinu Shalom. The Rav was such a chassid Hashem, the dikduk in mitzvot, the blowing of the shofar. You can't even start to understand. He blew shofar, they told me, with a stopwatch. He had a head to use a stopwatch to it, because at times the dikduk. I mean, you want another story about the Rav? I'll tell you one that you'll never stop laughing. It's a true story. There was a consul in Boston in the late 50s, early 60s, a frum guy. First time Israel today, they're offering people in the foreign service. This was a consul in Boston. So the consul comes. You know the story? I've told it, and people tell me they knew the consul from Boston. So the consul, the Israeli consul, comes over to the Rebbe and says, Rebbe, I would like to be at your second Seder. So the Rebbe says, fine, invites him. And the guy comes to the second Seder, and there's the Rav and the Rebbetzin and the children and, you know, the family. And the Rav, and this guy's in heaven. He's watching the Rav, and he's hearing the Divrei Torah. And then they reach the matzah menorah, and the guy washes, and he has a little piece of matzah. And the Rav says, I'll send you this. The Rav says, nay, Michal, I hold you have to observe Yantiv Sheni. The Rav Shita, listen to Rakefet's year and a half of Sheyuron on Yantiv Sheni. And the poor guy has been started eating the Rav Sheyuron of matzah and Mora and the Korach.
Tova says the consul told her he was sick, paraphrasing the Gemara, from Pesach to Shavuos, as a result of having to observe Yantav Sheni. No, is that a Hasidic story or a Litvisha story? My case rests. Asher, dar it out. No, Beseder. Well, that's the big deal. Do you see that he hears my tape? That's all. You're learning pshat. Zichrona levracha. So you're saying zachur latov instead of that. No, he meant zal. I don't find the problem that he didn't say zechut tzadik levracha was to save time. That's all. You don't say zitzal all the time. You say zal. That's miniga. I just quoted to you. What do you want? Give this guy the copy, please. Enjoy. Don't read it in class. Listen to me. I'm going to blow your minds in a second.
My Rebbe, my second grade Rebbe from Harvard Ash, he changed the word
Right, right. And
he on purpose changed the word to Zal.
Zal. In general, we say Zal. I didn't hear. I'll give you another example. You hear today people say Rashi HaKodesh. When I hear that, I get sick. That's all I can tell you. Rashi HaKodesh. Okay, let's roll. Chaim, you should hear the first part. You're not going to hear this anywhere else in your life, and then you'll have something. Okay, so what are we? We're in the middle of unbelievably fascinating halachic material that was never asked before, should never ever be asked again. Unfortunately, we live with these problems all the time. And we were dealing with triage. We were dealing with the Mishnah at the end of Horiyot. We were dealing whether the status of a Talmud Chacham applies today. And we actually saw that the Rabbi Menashe Katner of Brooklyn, Rabbi Menashe Klein with Paschal Halacha, that if Baruch says, I'm a Johnny come lately, I can't live well, I can't learn well, what am I worth? But this guy is a big London, I want to give my life for him. And he goes, love it to the Gestapo, free him, and I'll give my life. Rabbi Menashe Klein would say, go, not only you should do it, it's a mitzvah to do it. Ad kedei kach, and I admire a man that has great the places that he could paskin like that. The Mekadshei Hashem didn't paskin like that, etc. Now, and with all that we spoke about, and Pidyon Shvuyim, and Ein Marbin, I found another source. So I slightly want to go back. I'll pick up what I said last week in a moment, but I found another source. And I found something in print very interesting. I was living in Israel at the time. Part of this I know to be a fact. Part of it I have to accept what's written here because I was not in America. And I'm quoting from Reb Heschel Shechta. How many of you are Talmidim of Reb Tzvi Shechta? Okay, I'm quoting from your Rebbe. The Ikvei Hatzon, this is his latest volume, as far as I recall. I think, no, it's next to the latest. It came out between the two volumes on the Rav then. It came out in 1997. Yes, so it's right in between. And he has a tremendous article on Milchemet Mitzvah and the State of Israel. And believe me, if the Mashkiach we quoted before, the Parishman at Sibur, is familiar with this article, he would be very, very upset. It's a real halachic Zionist understanding of the State of Israel and all that's happening. But he's dealing here with a very interesting story. In 1970, three planes were hijacked to Jordan. I don't know, you're too young to remember the incident. I remember it well because my neighbor's daughter and son-in-law were on one of those planes. My cousin's wife, not yet his wife at the time, she was a teenage girl, but my cousin's wife was on that plane as well, on one of the planes. Anyway, the three planes were hijacked to Jordan. One was Al Al. Or the Al Al plane was a different story. There they shot it out in the air. It was a whole story. They reached England, but the Mechablin got away in England. It's a terrible story, what the English did, let them run free. But the two planes, I think it was two that were actually hijacked. They attempted to hijack three, but the Al Al made it to London.
the other two planes were in Jordan. And it was a terrible period. That was before the black massacres. The Jordanian king later starts massacring those that are opposing his government. And here they are among the people in Jordan, is Rav Yitzchak Chutna, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. And Rav Heschel tells the story, V'la az alev cheve mitalmidav ha-shirim lahagish kama milyonei dollarim le-misrat ha-chutz shel Atzot Habrit sheyagishu chim hon zeh la-aravim ha-terroristim al menat sheyishachru et rabam ha-gon Rav Yitzchak Chutna. And this was the plan. I remember hearing about it. I don't have to tell you, it caused a great commotion. First of all, are you allowed to do this halachically? Everything we spoke about, Ein Podinat Ashvuyim, the Mishnah in Gittin, Yotel Kedei de Mayhem. And here, you're willing to give them millions of dollars for Rav Yitzchak Chutna. And even if you look into the halacha, even if what the Shulchan Aruch brings down in the sources I quoted, that if it's a great Talmud Chacham, but there's another terrible problem here, that look what you're doing. You're mavchin ben dam ledam. Hundreds of Jews are caught in Jordan in a desert. Their lives hang in the balance. What they went through, you know, one of the planes were blown up. They had no place to hide, and the Jordanian troops came in and they shot it out with the terrorists, and they were a few feet away. Had any bullet gone astray, who knows what could have happened? Are you allowed to suddenly be paid there, one individual? And imagine what this would do to the spirit of the detainees, of the captured the civilians, the captured Jews, lo aleinu. It's a big debate. Who came out against it? See, this I didn't know. I know that there was opposition, but according to Reb Heschel, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Rosh Yeshiva, you said you went to Teira Vadas, the Rosh Yeshiva of Teira Vadas, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, came out totally against it. And he gave a very fascinating reason. It's not just the reasons that I gave, which are valid, the problems I raised. Everyone else was discussing it. Rabbi Yaakov turned around and said that the whole concept of being pulled to Shvuyim is a concept at a time of peace. Here it's a time of war. And if you give the terrorists millions of dollars, you are helping the enemy at a time of war. And Rabbi Yaakov went on to say that the state of Israel, these words, unfortunately, is true today. It was said with all our mourning for the 8 young men who were murdered in Merkaz Harav. This same thought was expressed so many years later, almost 40 years later. We've been at war since 1947. From the time the UN voted partition, you can even say we've been at war going back to the 1880s, but from the time the UN voted partition, the time we declared the state, we have been at war. And when people are at war, there's no din of pidyon shvuyim, just the opposite. You're helping the enemy. This is a milchamet mitzvah. This is a milchamet to save the Jews living in Israel. This is a milchamet, according to the Rambam, to conquer the land. And if you wind up being paid there and giving them money, you are helping the enemy at a time of war, which is absolutely, totally, completely forbidden. And Rav Heschel tells the story that the Talmidim of Rav Chutna didn't listen. And they approached the State Department, and the State Department refused to take the money, refused to act. The State Department evidently held that if you would redeem Rabbi Chutna, it would enhance and ennoble the terrorist, lo aleinu, And Rav Heschelin saw this little part of the article, V'lo haya amal afalpel beklal, that had they known the State Department wouldn't accept the idea, there's nothing to talk about. Here they got involved in a whole debate and a whole argument, and the truth of the matter was that the State Department ruled in favor of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky very loudly and clearly. Now, you'll find this story in the Be'ikvei Hatzon, beginning on page 206. Be'ikvei Hatzon, that's what the Sefer is called, by Reb Tzvi Schechter. Beginning on page 206, you will find this particular story. The Kuntress dealing with Milchemet Mitzvah and Medinat Yisrael of today begins on page 205 and continues through page 221. Okay, so I just cite that source as an addendum to what we've been speaking about for many weeks. You'll ask me, is this description totally accurate? I can only tell you that the first part of it I know to be accurate because I heard about it here and there was very heated debate and many people here were very angry that the students could think of such an idea because it's mafkin ben dam to dam at such a terrible moment in Torah history. There was a lot of opposition. I know in America there was opposition, but I didn't realize if Reb Heschel was correct, it is Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, who certainly was a key figure on the American Torah scene, who led the opposition. And what's fascinating is that even if they wanted to go through with it, despite Reb Yaakov, the State Department nixed it with a large N-O, a large no. Fascinating source, a very sad story. I know people who were there, people who came out. There was the rabbi, he lives in Malé. His parents live in Malé Adumim today, if I'm not mistaken. He lives here. The whole family came in Aliyah as a result. There were many wonderful people who were part of that hijacked group, and they felt that they were reborn. They told me that if Rav Huttner would have been redeemed, it would have been a terrible, terrible psychological blow for the people who were captured there. And you see, his students in America may have meant well, but they dragged their Rebbe into a situation that for the people in Jordan was a terrible, terrible trauma. Baruch Hashem, everyone was saved. There's a sad part to the story. I don't know if you're aware of it, but the Israeli plane, I think her name was Laila Chalaib, you can correct me with the name. I think she's in Lebanon today. So what happened was, I can tell you what happened. It's very sad, and then, you know, this is life. Unfortunately, it's just unbelievable how human beings, Yetzalev Adam Ram Binurav, what happened with Governor Spitzer is nothing new, and it's repeated in every circumstance and all over the world, and lo aleinu, in our circles as well. So what happened on the plane, it all comes back to me. The El Al plane, the terrorist pulled their guns, and the Israeli security person was doing something he shouldn't be doing with a stewardess. Until he pulled himself together and came out of where he was, they had the upper hand. A gun battle then broke out on the plane. The Israeli people subdued the terrorist, but one of them or two of them were injured. You can check the newspapers, get all the details. It's 1970, it's the summer. Very famous episode. Because they were injured, the plane could not turn back to Lod. Lod was too far, and they had to get to London very quickly to see that these people got medical treatment to save their lives. When they went to London, the British government released the terrorist. That's what happened. Had hanky-panky not been taking place on the plane, and had the security people been in position, they would have subdued the terrorists, and the plane would have come back to Lod, and we would have spared ourselves many murders in the future from the terrorists that were on that plane. I know that one or two of them are dead already. We killed them subsequently. Laya Khalad, if I'm pronouncing it right, and I stand open to correction, check it out on a website, on the internet, find it in a magic way that you can. If I'm not mistaken, she's back in Lebanon today. I believe she may still be alive. Okay, excuse me? No, she was a terrorist. She was a terrorist. Okay, now, the problem we raised last week, was, of course, a very famous question. Is it permitted to place yourself in Safek Sakana to save Jews who are in Vadai Sakana? And this was the famous question that Rabbi Freimer Shri got from the Slabato Mashkiach, Rabbi Avraham Grzyzanski, and we devoted most of last week's Sheyua to it. And Halacha Lamaisa, while we can't force anyone to place himself in Safek Sakana, but quoting the Aruch HaShulchan, quoting the Netziv, it's a great mitzvah. And one has to recognize that saving other Jews at times entails great danger, but do not desist from doing it. What's fascinating about the trip, we went to the Makarot, but what's fascinating is his description of the Lithuanians. And this, of course, is what haunts us until today, and we see it day in and day out, how the hatred for the Jew is so overwhelming that the Lithuanians were overjoyed to cooperate with the Nazis. And you see it today. It defies imagination. The whole world is anti-Israel, which is just a cold word. What's her title? Merkel, the woman visiting her, the chancellor of the German Republic. She said it openly that they're hiding behind the anti-Israel, just anti-Semitism, and in every country, the Jews were, the Poles, the Ukrainians, the Lithuanians, the Latvians, the White Russians, how they cooperated. It's overwhelming. How their very neighbors, they took away their property, took away their possessions, they rejoiced at their death. And he describes the Lithuanians, how they cooperated. And that's where this person asking the question, who was a rabbi, an executive director of the Rabbinical Association, and he knew these Lithuanians. He had contacts with these Lithuanians, and he knew them before the war. How Reb David Itzkowitz asked, should I endanger myself? I know these people. And Reb Mazensky asked Reb Chaim Rastri the question. And he endangered himself and he saved them. But the end of the story is very sad because this goes on over the Holocaust time and time again. You're saved once, you're saved twice, the third time you're killed. And everyone he saved was later killed. This is what makes the rescue of the Belzer Rebbe so unique. Because if you're familiar with that story in toto, time and again, the Rebbe is saved. If I'll use Chassidic Lashon, which will make Kol Hamavasa feel good, miracle after miracle. And he gets out of it. That's what's amazing. Time and again he's saved. In Hungary, in Romania, in each place he goes to, Poland, to Romania, to Hungary, time and again he's saved, and he gets out of it. He reaches Eretz Yisrael. Most people were not so fortunate. Now, then at the end of the class, we dealt with two contemporary questions. Number one, a soldier, Kiryat Shmona, a policeman. This question just came up in Merkaz Harav a week and a half ago. Kids are captured by terrorists. The school is under the control of terrorists. Do you put your life in danger to save the kids? Or do you say Hayecha Koltman? That was the first question. And the answer is, this is what's involved with being a soldier, what's involved with being a policeman. Certainly in the state of Israel, where we're involved in the Chemet Mitzvah, you absolutely are obligated to put your life in danger. The question of sakonet nefashot no longer applies. It's a milchemet mitzvah. And the chayal or the policeman or the shelter had to run into the school, do his best, the Savoy Hotel. We had endless examples of the Entebbe Rescue Michigan, where Netanyahu's brother Yonatan is killed. You should know that Mishnah had two students. One of the medical doctors was a BMT boy, and one of the elite unit, the reconnaissance unit that went in, was another BMT boy. I had two students in that unit. Maybe the first, the medical doctor, I think, was my student in America yet, not in Israel, but the second one was my student in BMT. And of course, their lives were in risk 100%, but that's what Mohammed Mitzvah is all about. The second question was, and by the way, that's what came up Thursday night. The police now are investigating as much as you can investigate. It turns out that they called the police, a new police officer, and a female policewoman, a new policeman. He had just graduated, was now a policeman, and they're called to Mecca Sarav, and you all know the story. Instead of breaking into the building while the shooting is going on and killing the Machabel, he stood outside the building keeping people from going in, and she went to stop a bus from turning into the street. And it's mind-boggling, and it's a very frightening thought, because this is mamish. You hear the shots. What is a policeman supposed to do if not go in and try to kill and shoot the Machabel? Very frightening. But this child, it just came up. Halakha l'maisa, of course, the police are investigating. There's a whole affair at the Renaissance Hotel where they're going to tell the story, the two people who killed the Machabel, the Mekas Arab student of today, and the former Mekas Arab student who's an officer in the army. He can go very far now. The chief of staff called him to thank him. I mean, that's what you call seichel. He heard shooting, grabbed his gun, and ran down the block into the yeshiva. And I don't know exactly who shot the Machabel first, whether he or the student in Mekas, but the two them, thank God, if the eight were dead, who knows what else could have been. Hashem Yirachem. The second question is what I dedicate to Roe Klein, and we're going to talk about that question today. Can you throw yourself on a grenade and kill yourself, but by killing yourself, you will save many of your friends? And here in Noam, I quoted the source to you last week. It's Noam Yud Zayin, beginning on page Kuf Tet Zayin 116. The halacha, he paskins la halacha, that you are not obligated to throw yourself on a grenade. Your life, hayecha kodmim, who says their blood is redder. No one is obligated to give his life to save somebody else. And he paskins that way, la halacha ula ma'aseh. Now, let's pick up with new material, beyond Reb Heschel's new material. Gentlemen, I'm about to quote perhaps one of the most famous lines that Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook ever wrote. You're going to have a little medley afterwards of so many different comments on these lines. But first you need a few words of introduction. Who is Rav Cook? So right away, Binyamin Rosenzweig will tell you he was the first chief rabbi, he was a great Zionist, a great thinker, a great philosopher. What you don't realize is that Rav Cook was first and foremost a Volozhiner yeshiva boy, the Talmud Muvhak of the Netziv of Volozhin. He was a gon adir in simple yeshiva learning. Besides that, he was everything else. He resembles the Rav in that respect. The Rav has one tremendous problem for his legacy, that what he published was philosophy. The tens of thousands of shiurim, of chidushin, of bris v'lashon, that was never published. even the little bit that's published, like Sheirim Lezeicha Abba Mori, all the great Israeli professors can understand this philosophy. They can't understand one word of Sheirim Lezeicha Abba Mori, not because they don't know Hebrew, but simply because they're not trained in yeshiva thinking in Velashin and Brisk. So that people will describe the Rav, the great philosopher, the great Baal Machshava, the Agudist who became a Mizrachist. It's all they can understand. That is so distant from the Rav's basic gestalt, like I'm being on the moon now instead of sitting in Gris Kolel in the center of Yerushalayim. The Rav's basic gestalt was a Rosh Yeshiva with Shas and Paiskim and learning and a Rambam and a Hezba and a Reb Chaim Hizeda. That was the Rav. Everything else was icing on the cake. Now, you have to be aware, I can still remember we were learning with Rav Shmuel Lezer Volk, the big Telza. I'm telling this, I have a Talmud in Lakewood listening, who's a Nainikel, so I want to tell a story. So, fascinating. One time, Rav Shmuel Lezer says a Chiddush, I think we're learning Baba Batra, a beautiful Chiddush. We had a fellow in class who was very bright. Goes on to become a medical doctor, but he gets smicha from Rav Moshe. Let me mention his name, Rabbi Dr. Melvin Zalewski. Anyone recognize the name? I think he lives in where does he live? New Jersey? Teaneck. Very, very bright. Is he bright in the Talmud Chacham? I was upset. He got smicha from Rav Moshe, and he was a skilled man. That year, he was older, infinitely smarter than me, and he shoots up and he says, Rebbe, to Rav Volk, the Chiddush you're saying, Rav Kook said, it's an Ishim V'Shitat. Ishim V'Shitat is by Rav Shlomo Yosef Zeben. It's a sefer you should be familiar with. It's a wonderful sefer on Gedola Yisrael and their derech and learning. And he has a whole entry in Rav Kook and Zalewski. Brings it in from the library. The library was down the hall. They got it from the library. And we show it to Rav Volk. And Rav Volk, oh, at Kikenta Bissel learning. You know, Rav Volk had this feeling. He's a Tzioni. He's a this. He's a that. Oh, boy. Rav Volk saw Rav Kook. The basis was for Lashon. Now, that's one word of introduction. A second word, and why we suffer. Why do we suffer? Why does Rabbi Reuben suffer? Who saw the letter that Yitzchak has from the Rav? Because Rabbi Reuben, who grew up in Boston and who knew the Rav from childhood on, whose father was a balabas of the Rav, who would ask the same question every few years, and the Rav would remind him, Mr. Reuben, you asked that question 3 years ago. And he didn't give an answer. Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. He wrote to the Rav, Rebbe, why don't you publish? And the Rav wrote back, it's high time. I should listen to you and publish. No, he wrote him a nice letter. He made him feel good. Like Barry Bonds writing to me, Dear Aaron, I guarantee you I never took bodybuilding substances and every home run was an original creation like your Shayurim. Your devoted disciple, Barry Bonds Jr. Ah, Teretz Van Bubba. But at least I feel good. You felt good. You got the answer. I feel good. Now, what is the problem? All this is going to be published. There are thousands of tapes circulating, manuscripts. But it will never be on the level as if the master himself had published. That's the nature of life. David, you want to prove? Let's turn you into a T.H., a Talmud Chacham. I'll give you a beautiful proof. You've heard of Reb David Zvi Hoffman? So he published on Chumash in his lifetime Vayikra and Devarim. Those two volumes are fabulous. Many years later, they found scribblings on Bereshit and I think it's Vamidbar, maybe Shmot. They published it. There's no comparison to the level of what he published to what they found in Kitvei Yad and try to put together. Follow me? So we suffer. Same thing with Rav Kook. Rav Kook wrote more than anyone alive. He wrote whatever he learned. He wrote his machadosh. He wrote. He never edited. He never went through it a second time. Chaim Nachman Bialik. Asher, you've heard the name. What am I supposed to say? Zal or Zitzalan of Chaim Nachman Bialik? Which one is it? He was an Avalozhin student. He was a chaver of Rav Kook from Avalozhin. He went a little off the path. It would have been better. But he remained with strong Torah feeling. Baruch Hashem, Onik Shabbat in Tel Aviv. He remained with Avalozhin in his veins, if you're familiar with his poetry. So Chaim Nachman Bialik, Zal, said about Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen HaKook Zitzal. He said as follows, I quote him word by word, Rav Kook writes much better than I do, but he leaves his first draft and goes on. My first draft doesn't equal his, but I polish it, so that when I finally publish, it's on a higher level. And that's exactly right. Rav Kook wrote. He published very little during his lifetime. Later, and until today, there are entire institutions that are publishing his writings. But we don't know for sure, what did he mean? What was the outcome? What was the maskana? What was he getting at? Did he really agree? And this is always a problem with Rav Kook's writings. Excuse me? It's not so much lack of context as it's not a finished product. And you know what he's writing, you know what he's saying, but you got to work very hard to figure out, is this really the maskana, the outcome, the final word? It's not that the master signed off on it. Bialik, Lahavdil on his poetry, signed off. Rav Kook never published this. This was found Kitvei Yad, like we're digging up from the Rav today. You don't just dig up Kitvei Yad, you dig up tapes. Rabban Kotler, they put together from tapes, from recordings. Here, it's endless Kitvei Yad, but it's an unfinished, unedited symphony. Now, the emergence of ethical man is a prime example, where they found this notebook from the Rav of magnificent material, no ending, no conclusion. They don't know where he did it, where he delivered these lectures, and they had the fellow in it's a fellow in Atlanta. He teaches at Emory College. He put together the ending. And I want to tell you, he did a very nice job. But the ethical man, imagine Moshe had the Rav finished it and published it. It would have been much, we would know, what is he finally saying? Can we be sure? What the editor did was guesswork. Did a beautiful job. But we can never be sure. This was the Rav's conclusion. That's the exact example I wanted to give, but I didn't give it for fear no one here has read The Ethical Man. You have to study and sweat with it. You should know that there was a woman who was a nun for many years and knew sacred theology. And I told her, you have to study The Ethical Man. It'll open your eyes. I have a Talmud who left the path and became an Episcopalian minister, and now he's a Reformed Jew. I'm the only one in the world that starts up with him, you understand? I do not lack guts. I don't look this way or that way. I just look up to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and I look at my students to see their faces. That's very important, the interaction. So I told them when The Ethical Man came out, he says to me, I have questions that Rabbi Lichtenstein couldn't answer. You couldn't answer. Questions. Rabbi Islam, if we could answer all the questions, it wouldn't be faith. It would be fact. Faith is faith. And munah. So I told them, the ethical man will answer your questions. Because I know what his questions are. I wrote him all the details. But I never heard from him again. I think he's at the age where Shuvu, Banim, Shovav. I don't want to go into Dashanut now, but you reach an age where sometimes it's too late to come back. You understand? You're caught up. The Rav used to say, you're caught up in life. What will my wife say? What will my children say? What will my friends say? And that's the hardest shuvah, that you want to come back, But all this thing around you, it means breaking with your total surroundings. Not everyone can do that. Anyway, now let me come here. What I'm quoting from is Mishpat Kohen. Those of you familiar with Rav Kook's writings, this is supposedly his chidushim that deal with Choshen Mishpat. With that area, Choshen Mishpat, Hilcha Malachim, it's Mishpat Kohen. There on all the Chelkei Shulchan Aruch, you have material from Rav Kook. I'm quoting from page Shin Lamed Tet. And he deals with this very question of an individual sacrificing himself for somebody else. And Rav Kook says here, and again, it's accepted lemaskana. I'm not certain. It may just be a svara in the middle of a long chidush Torah. But he says, for one person to give his life for another person, absolutely not. Who says the other person's blood is redder? And you're not obligated to give your life. The other person is caught. They're going to kill him. They're going to execute him. They're going to hang him. All right. It's sad. It's terrible. No one is happy about it. But your blood is your blood. His blood is his blood. No one can decide whose blood is redder. And I don't have to tell you. This is a fact of life. It goes with the greatness of the human being. We all have innate dignity and greatness and divine image in ourselves. Whose blood is redder? We cannot say. Bochin lebavat Hashem. We are not on that level. So that's forbidden. But then he throws a bombshell. And it could be, he says, with the yachid kineged rabim, lo shaychas farazu. Mishum da kol yodim, du dama de rabim, sumak tvei, mi dama de yachid. And here Rav Kook says it openly, that it could very well be when it's one Jew saving many, give your life, your blood. It's common sense. Labriya, two against one, three against one, 10 against one. Didn't we deal with this in that volume, Nishira? It's common sense. Their blood is redder. 10 Jews are infinitely more important than one Jew. And if you can save 10 lives, go ahead and do it. And according to Rav Kook, and who knows if Roy Klein, Hashem Yikom Damo, Zeichet Tzadik, Bekadosh Levracha. Who knows if this line in Rav Kook did not inspire him. It's an amazing thing. And he takes it common sense. There's a Kesef Mishnah. I don't want to go into detail now. But if you work out the whole sugya and you saw the Atara, the Kesef Mishnah actually asked this question. Why can't we surrender one life for 10, even if the why they want to kill is not Chayav Miti, it's not Sheva Ben Bichri, it's common sense. And Rav Kook seems to say, he formulates it. Again, it's hard to tell whether this is just part of a long analysis, or is this his maskana. But wow, now you come back to the question of throwing yourself on a grenade. Where I showed you the source in Noam, where Shlomo Naiman, Rav Shlomo Naiman, takes for granted you're not allowed to give your life, even for 10, 20, 30, 40. Who can say whose blood is redder? That's a very difficult question. What do you mean blood is redder? What do you mean blood is redder? I have taught over 11,000 students over the last, those of you who were at the weekend, the president of Yeshiva University suddenly recognized, I'm teaching Torah many years, my 49th year. Were you there? Who saw? Remember, you asked me how many years? You thought it was 53. Got confused. I said, next year's the 50th, Bezrat Hashem. I've taught over 11,000 students. Tell me, they're all equal? I have students, a few, who are worth, each one is worth 100, 1,000, what they did with their lives. They changed the world. I have other students, thieves. Right or wrong, drug pushers. Involved with every, I'm very proud to tell you in what, I don't go into details, but what happened in New Jersey, the one person with the call girl that they sent to entice, I don't want to go into details, Kvod Hashem Hastadab, front page of the New York Times, the one person who refused the call girl is my student. I'm proud of it. BMT, late 70s, check the New York Times, you'll get the name. I am proud. Now, what are you talking about? One against 100, one against 1,000, one against 10,000. You have certain students change their life. I can tell you, after World War II, I grew up in the shadow of individuals that were out to change the world after the Holocaust. I can mention names. Meir Kahana, Hashem Yikom Damo. Shlomo Kabach, Zichrono Levracha. Yubada L'chaim Aruchim, David Hartman. He said, they're out to change the world. And each one, their lives are high. Each one has critics. I don't have to tell you, I'm certainly no fan of the last one, the innovative Jewish philosophers, I refer to him. But the Schleimler, Meir, Robertson Jungreis, Esther Jungreis, I knew her yet from Bnei Akiva, knew her husband, knew her cousin, Binyamin Jungreis, changed the world. There are a lot of dopes that I was in Bnei Akiva with. What became of them? Social Security numbers. Miriam Beinhorn Levinger, my wife's Madricha, Michael Madrich from the Bronx, we're the same age. Miriam always used to say, I want to make a difference with my life. Our family ran away from Hungary to escape Hitler. I want to make a difference. No, she married Reb Moshe Levinger. If Jews are living in Yehuda B'Shomram today, you have to thank Miriam Beinhorn Levinger. She made a difference or she didn't make a difference, I share. I don't know. There are people here who will tell you our greatest tragedy is that we run into Yehuda B'Shomram. It's mind-boggling, the self-hatred and lack of connection to the Eretz Yisrael. It's beyond comprehension at times. But Rav Kook predicted it. You want a Hasidic story in Rav Kook? There's a letter he wrote in the early 1900s to a Rosh Yeshiva whose sons became big Zionists and irreligious, and he's comforting the father. And he writes, ultimately, if Zionism will be without Torah, there'll be no Jews left. Their grandchildren will hate the land and will leave the land. Can you believe it? Look at the Israeli government. Go one by one by the Salim today and ask where their children live. You will be shocked. So Rav Kook, that's what he wrote. But here, who can say lives equal? It's a very difficult question. We can debate it endlessly. Oh no, so to save one life of these great Jews is worth losing 1,000 fools. Or no. Let's take the other approach, which fortunately or unfortunately is the one I live by. My wife gets mad at me. She says, you never had a student that you were mad at. You never had a student who you said was bad. Like Kaffet says, they're no bad students, they're only bad teachers. Every student, every human being has divine image. Every human being has sacredness. Every human being is unique. Every human being can be inspired to strive for sanctity. Okay, we're not all equally bright. That's a fact of life. But the searching for God? We all have that Selim Udmut. It's a very difficult question. But Rav Kook says very simply, you make a cheshbon, we're not God, we're only human beings, and there's no question the blood of one Jew is not worth the blood of 10 Jews. And if you can jump on a grenade and blow yourself up and save the lives of 10 other Jews, you are doing a tremendous, meritorious, wonderful act. Oh boy. It's Rav Kook. Baruch, you won't believe the source I'm about to quote. You won't believe it. Because you've been studying in a world where if you don't have the same hashkafa, you can't quote. Rakefid's world, we forget all hashkafas. We're learning Torah. We quote. Hashkafas here today, gone tomorrow. I'll match my hashkafa with anyone. But when I quote the Dechilu Rechimo. Gentlemen, Harav Moshe Sternbuch. Who is he? What do you say, Eitan? Who is he? These today, the Avdeistin of the Eidach Haredit. He, by the way, his English. Ashad, you met Rav Moshe Sternbuch? Go to Hanof. You'll find it very fascinating. Rav Moshe Sternbuch speaks perfect English. This is part of the Soloveitchik family. It's the Swiss family. He was Avdeistin in South Africa for many years. So while his English may not be exactly the English that we speak in Yankee Stadium, it is the English they speak when the cannibals are getting the fire ready in Cape Town and Johannesburg. My apologies to the Jews there, but we know what's going on. Now, where did this article appear, Rav Moshe Sternbuch? Where did this article appear? In Yad Sha'ul. Yad Sha'ul was a volume published in memory of Reb Shaul Weingott. Anyone know who I'm talking about? Who is Reb Shaul Weingott? What's the connection with Reb Moshe Sternbuch? Gentlemen, knowledge is precious. Let me give you a little injection. Reb Shaul Weingott was the Talmud Muvhak before World War II of the Sri Dei Eish. Reb Michiel Yaakov Weinberg, Zatzal. Let me be careful. Asher, he married into the Butchko family. The Butchkos had established the little yeshiva in Switzerland. I think it's pronounced Montreuil, if I'm pronouncing it right. If not, correct me. How do I pronounce it? Montreuil? Montreuil? Let it be Montreuil. And Eitz Chaim, the yeshiva was called. Reb Shaul Weingott became the Rosh Yeshiva there. But we have no muscle. After World War II, when the Sri Dei Eish survived, childless, penniless, no place to go, no place to live, Reb Shaul Weingott took his Rebbe in, built him a little, what they call a mother and daughter complex, built him a little daughter apartment. And he said, Rebbe, for the rest of your life, you have no problems, no worries. We are taking care of you. But we Jews have no muzzle. Within 1 year, Reb Shaul Weingott always had lunch with his Rebbe. They spoke and learning. He was now late going to the yeshiva. So instead of walking, he took a trolley car. He was thinking, and when the trolley car came along, it ran him over. He was caught up in thought. He was killed. His son, Reb Avram Abba, who was a first-rate Talmud Chacham, tzaddik, human being, etc., was raised on the lap of the Sri Dei Eish. He was the Sri Dei Eish's Talmud Mufak after World War II. And he devotes his life to perpetuating his Rebbe's memory and his Rebbe's writings. So this is a volume in memory of Reb Shaul Weingott. That's why it's called Yad Sha'ul. Rav Weinberg, the Swedish, was the editor of the volume, was contributors to the one of the contributors. Now, how does Rav Moshe Sternbuch come to this volume? Because he's from Switzerland. And the Sternbuch family and the Butchko and the Weingott families were all interconnected. Now, what's fascinating here is he's writing on this very topic. I'm quoting from beginning on page Shin Ayin Zion. That would be 377. Okay? And he says, I'm told that look at the Derech Eretz, Moreinu Harav Hagon, Reb Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Zitzal, in his Sefer Mishpatei Kohen, deals with this very issue and reaches the conclusion, Umasik Nahayachet Sarichlim Son Nafshal Lachatzil Rabim, and that an individual can give his life to save the many. He has a right to give his life to save the many. This is what they tell me Rav Kook wrote. He says, I can't look at the sefer. I don't have it here. This was probably being written in Switzerland, but people have told me about this. But he says, I don't agree. Very difficult. L'chadesh davak zem midatenu? And he brings the Noda B'Yehuda that we spent so many weeks on to prove that Rav Kook is wrong. Why? Because remember what the Shaila was in the Noda B'Yehuda? The Shaila was about a married woman committing adultery with the arch pirate Ark Listim, the main pirate, and in return, and she was the way the other describes her, a beautiful woman. They're having a field day now with the governor's mistress, if we will dignify it, and she was a beautiful woman, and by living with this pirate, all the lives would be spared. And the Noda B'Yehuda was not happy that she did it. Do you remember? He took issue with the Beis Yaakov. And he, the Noda B'Yehuda says, don't bring me a proof from Esther Hamalka. Esther Hamalka was al pi hadibur. There was Ruach HaKodesh. The Esther Shiny, the Stal Pihorat, Mordechai Ubeitino, Al Piruach HaKodesh. And he quotes the Noda B'Yehuda, and therefore he says, how can Rav Kook be matir, a person committing suicide, to save the lives of 100 other people? You're not the master over your life. Your blood belongs to God. This is ma'abeda, that's moladat. And he doesn't agree with Rav Kook. It's not so simple. And if someone would ask you, do I have a right to give my life to save 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 other Jews? The Yad Shaul would be very hesitant to be matir. And here he comes in. Everybody with me? He doesn't. He says, the Noda B'Yehuda disproves Rav Kook. Of course, the sources that the Noda B'Yehuda quotes, as we trace them back in class, you can make a very strong case for Rav Kook if you take all the sources going back to the Beit Yaakov, going back to the Shvut Yaakov, going back to the Marik. You could make a very strong case for Rav Kook's position. But he doesn't have the sefer of Rav Kook, and he says what he was told, and he quotes these sources, but only basically the Noda B'Yehuda, and therefore he reaches the conclusion that Rav Kook may not be correct. Now, wait a minute. What's the problem with committing suicide? We're going to spend many shayurim on this down the line. But what's the problem? What's the problem? I mean, just very briefly. You've all, I trust, are familiar with Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, Perek Hay. The Rambam already touches upon this problem. We know that in every case, you can be Mechalel Shabbos, you can do every sin outside of the three cardinal sins. Pikuach Nefesh Docha Kol HaTorah Kula. You know very well that when it comes to medicine, there's not the slightest question that we can swallow pills that have taphis in them. It could very well be with a pill you can say it's not eating, it's shiloka derech achila. But imagine if you had to eat tafras. If there was something where you had to eat, and this was pikuach nefesh, you'd be allowed. There's no shaya. Chilul Shabbos, I don't have to tell you. We're Mechalo Shabbos. Hospitals function on Shabbos. Ambulances function on Shabbos. This is Meika Halacha. I don't have to tell you the Son of Israel try to pick on us with the famous story out of the 60s. I remember it. You weren't alive yet. Where suddenly there are headlines all over the world that a Goyish tourist passed out on the streets of Meir Shalom, and the Meir Shalom Jews refused to call an ambulance. And then it turned out that the whole story was not even true. It never happened. Lo dubim v'lo ya. But I remember the Rav had to relate to it. Rabbi Soloveitchik had to relate to it. And of course, we call an ambulance for a Gentile like a Jew today. I don't want to go into the reasons. But halacha l'maisa, we treat a person who is monotheistic no differently than a Jew. But I want to ask a question. What if a person said, I don't want to eat this tafas. I'd rather give my life than eat the tafas. What if a person said, I don't want to be Mechalel Shabbos. I'd rather give my life than be Mechalel Shabbos. And by the way, I can tell you halacha l'maisa, it actually happened. We're now in the ship, Erica Jesselson, Zichrono Levracha, who did so much for YU. I can tell it's an unbelievable joke. And you should know that he took ill on Shabbos in the plaza, and he told his family not to call an ambulance. He can wait till after Shabbos. He's not that ill. That waiting till after Shabbos ended his life. If you want to know about Rabbi Israel Miller, who we dedicated the Beit Medrash in his memory, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, Rabbi Miller took ill on Shabbos, or on Yontif, whatever it was, and he said, I learned from Ludi Jesselson to call an ambulance immediately, and it prolonged his life. They were able to help him, and he lived a nice few years afterwards. But I want to ask you a question. Kiddush Hashem. Not always are you chayv and Kiddush Hashem. There are no 10 Jews there. They want you to change shoelaces. It's not for Parhesia. It's not Shat Hashmad. I'm referring to the Gemara in Sanhedrin where they're changing the color of shoelaces. No? What about if you say, I know I'm not obligated, but I will give my life rather than make a change that this Gentile wants? No? Huh? Is he ma'abed at atzmo ladat, or is he a good Jew? So I want you to know that it's a machloket rishonim. Moshe quoted the Rambam to me. The Rambam taka says, Mischayev b'nafsho. He's murdering himself. What's the difference if I murder a third party or if I murder myself? Ma'abedat atzmo ladat. And you should know that there are many rishonim, particularly the Ashkenazic rishonim, that considered such a Jew a kadosh. There's endless literature. Now, to entertain Yitzchak for a minute, the Chachmei Yisrael learned pshat, it reflects their cultural background. In Sfarad, the Jews lived at peace with Islam. They were welcomed, they were honored. They didn't see the need for this type of Kiddush Hashem, quote, end quote. In Germany and France, where they suffered under the Catholic Church, the Crusades, and let's not forget how many hundreds of thousands of Jews died throughout the millennium, there they were conditioned, perhaps the Kiddush Hashem is more important than our lives. Very fascinating. There may be some truth to this. Do you follow me, Tzvi? It's a Chachmat Yisrael tries to read into halachic machlokes the social factors that surround that era. Look, you can buy it or not buy it. Rav Eshel Shecht has a whole discourse on this, quoting the Rav, with why we're so makel with a sukkah with the walls, right? You can build a sukkah, two walls, and the third wall can be very little, very limited. And yet, am I correct? And yet the sukkah is a kosher sukkah. How big does the walls have to be? It has to be 10 tefachim, right or wrong. That's not so much. And you have lavur, all types of halacha that is made here by sukkah. So the Chachma Yisrael learned pshat. It's because we lacked for trees in Eretz Yisrael. You follow? So I don't know. That's quite fanciful. So Yitzchak says that's why they don't bury in coffins. That could be. I don't want to argue. Reb Heschel describes that the Rav was not too happy with this. The Rav said no, that these were the halachot, but because we had these halachot, we were able to take advantage and be mekhil in Eretz Yisrael, where it was hard to build proper walls that go all the way up and build a proper sukkah with four good, wonderful, firm, strong walls. So say that, look into the Peshul, it's Nefesh HaRav. Say that, Yitzchak, if a person didn't have the lumber to build a sukkah, hey, so then he has a different shayla. Is he chayev to build a sukkah? He's mitzvah, doesn't have money. Listen, the Mishnah Halachas has a shayla. If you're obligated to go up to the country, it seems in Manhattan, to build a sukkah, or in Brooklyn, wherever it was, he describes, they were throwing rocks. The guy was throwing rocks into the sukkah. It was sakonet nefesh to sit in the sukkah. So the only way you could have a sukkah was to go up to the Catskills, but it cost a fortune. He has a whole tshuva on it. Hamavazbeis, al yavazbeis, yoter michomesh. But he taka paskins la'alacha that you're not obligated to sit in the sukkah if they're going to throw rocks in. And if you can't get up to the mountains, you can eat in your house. You'll see. It's a tshuva. It's an unbelievable tshuva from Reb Menashe Cotton. We haven't gotten there yet. We're going to deal with the Christian. Baruch Hashem. We'll get there. You're jumping ahead. We'll get there. Divide your question in half. Shaving off the beard, we already dealt with. It's mutter. But there were Jews who refused to shave and went to their deaths with their beards on. So this would be similar to the very question we're asking. So it's according to the Rambam, no. According to the Balei Tosfot, absolutely. Kadosh Yomulo. And he gives exactly your words. He says, for Chayberhem. He quotes you. Rav Moshe Steinberg is quoting Rav Yitzchak Rubin. For Chayberhem. Velo Sheyemut Behem. And he says, this is my beda that's small adat. But listen carefully. I'll end off the class with this. It's a very interesting part. So he says, I can understand the Rambam, but what about the Balei Tosfot? What about the Smak, the Sefer Mitzvot Katan? What about the other Rishonim that hold that this is a terrific act, a Kiddush Hashem? You gave your life not to transgress when you were not obligated to give your life. How can you hold like that? How can you think like that? How can you paskin like that? How can you differ with the Rambam? The Rambam is so logical. And Rav Moshe Steinberg says the following svara. What does suicide mean? So I'm quoting his words now. Suicide is when you kill yourself and no benefit to anyone, to anything. You kill yourself. Why? Katz umias b'chayei olam hazeh. These are people in a depression. You know, you're sick and tired of this world. I hate to tell you this, but teenagers, males, have the highest percentage of suicide. Second is men. It's very fascinating. Men in their middle age, springtime of the year. I've done my research on this because I saw too many suicides in my life. It's very interesting. It's people who turn 50 and they realize they're never going to achieve their dreams. They've achieved what they have and they're nowhere near what they dreamt of. And why in the spring? Because the whole world is renewing itself. Spring is a beautiful time, and they're caught up in a rut. They can't renew, they can't rejuvenate. And lo aleinu, I personally know three such people who committed suicide with their yarmulkes on. Exactly what I described to you. Early 50, springtime. One of them had an argument with the dean of his school, and he wasn't going to go anywhere else. One of them lost his position in the high school. Just exactly what I'm describing to you. So, God have mercy. One of them, I'm the one that it was a terrible time. The terrorist, the Secret Service, the Shin Bet didn't want to release the body for burial. They wanted to do an autopsy. They were Chayshish, it was an Arab terrorist. And I told him, I'll never forget it. I came back from shul and I stood Lo aleinu, what a sight. And I told him, this is 1978. I say to the Shin Bet, he was depressed. He talked with me and he lost his position. And I told him the story. And just then the widow comes down and they say to her, was he suffering from depression? She says, yes, he took pills. Show us the pills. The minute she brought the pills down, they released the body. And they told me that now it all ties together. So you see, to quote his words, teenage kid, a girl turned him down, he's ugly, his father put him down. By the way, it's very important, your relationship with your children, and always encourage. Don't put down, don't be negative, because it becomes self-fulfilling. Your students, they're the greatest. They're tzaddikim. They're lamdanim. They're fine human beings. When the kid walks away from his Rebbe, I'm talking about high school. I taught high school decades ago. You teach kids that age. The kid walks away. Oh, my Rebbe doesn't know me, but he makes me feel good. You know, let me try to prove my Rebbe right. You can't believe BMT, collegiate kids already. But we inspired. Baruch Hashem. That's a suicide that has no purpose. And that's totally forbidden. You have done nothing to enhance God's presence in the world. But when you commit suicide, even if the halacha doesn't require it, but you commit suicide because it has a purpose, like Hananiah, Mishael, Isaiah, we're going to go into that later on. It has a purpose. You refuse to be Machalel Shabbos. You refuse to change the shoes that you wear, the laces that you put in. That a Gentile is forcing you. It may be in private. It may not be b'toch b'nei Yisrael, as the pasuk says, but once there is a positive message, then it's no longer suicide. Relax. But as far as someone who refuses to eat treif medicine or refuses to be Machalel Shabbos, so there he says that's suicide. Because there's no Kiddush Hashem in your actions. Kiddush Hashem is when you stand firmly and look the Gentile in the eye. Now, we'll see what he does with this. Very fascinating. Quoting Rav Kook, you'll see more quotes, but it begins an entire literature. To reiterate, what did we do today? The Rebbe reacted to two questions you asked me, and I really didn't know what you were talking about. The Mashkiach, and what he said. Then I was sent a copy of what appeared in America, and then my daughter told me where it appeared here in print. And I understand already that question. I related to it, and I showed you a Rambam that you should never forget. Hilchot Tshuva, Perek Gimel, Halacha Yud Aleph. I related to that article in Kol HaMavaseh. You can have it. I don't need it back. I have a copy. Baruch Hashem. They gave it out wholesale at the Shabbos weekend. And then you don't know how upset the Rebbetzin Albert, she's the widow of the photographer who took all the pictures that appear in my book. And she was so upset by that article. Oh, my gosh. She was literally in tears. But, you know, I told her, don't take it that seriously. He wants to introduce a story, a concept. Why don't we have fairy tales about the Rav? I said, that's what I'm angry at, that he reaches a certain age and doesn't know there's a big nafkamina between a Hasidic story to a Litvish story. But that dummy Rakefet, I didn't tell the stories I told today are good. That gives you an idea of what Lit is about. Yeah, no, but the Rav is not really stories about him. It's the Rav's description of life. It's a little bit different. Now, then I quoted from Bikvei Hatzon, Rav Heschel Shechta. That's a fascinating story. With Rav Chutney, I can tell you the story is absolutely factual. I know it. I sign off on it. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, I depend upon Rav Heschel because I was not in America. Then we picked up, after the question of last week and throwing yourself on a grenade, we picked up with Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Then we went a drop further with Rav Moshe Sternbuch. Next Sunday, there is no class because you will all be drunk. I will not. On principle, I followed the Ramah, the Tosfot, my Rebbe, etc. Now, but tomorrow, don't miss the class for anything. America through the eyes of Rav Moshe. Next Monday, we'll continue. Now, I want to show you, I am going to aggravate Yitzchak. Yeah, I walked into class and Yitzchak asked me, what's wrong with women being called up to the Torah, etc.? I am giving him the guide for the halachic minyan that just came out on what to do. You'll see it is a falling snowball. It is a slippery slope. You will read this and even you will cry what has happened. And the worst part is they don't call it orthodox. They don't call it conservatism. Everyone wants to be Orthodox today. Next, anyone want a copy of this is a copy of, remember I quoted to you weeks ago, the legacy that was found, or they thought was found after World War II, by the survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto, Rabbi Yossel Rakova. This is a copy, it's available. It's in Hebrew. Anyone want Kashrut in Israel, the latest pronouncements of the chief rabbinate? And part of this was halacha lemaisa for me, because a type of chopped turkey I buy, they say here they're big phonies, they put a shtempel on kosher lePesach, and it's not. The store I buy from, I saw today, they changed the brand to a Rehovot rabbinate, which better be a good hashgacha.